just like I used it a lot. So I feel kind of weird that this is 6 pages for 3 problems.
Whoa.
And the last problem itself, where we were supposed to find representative matrices for being
yeah.
isomorphism.
Mm-hmm.
Like there, I running 4 factorizations itself takes up more than a page. So that's what you get for telling us to include all output.
Yeah, there may be tricks that you didn't think of and wouldn't know about. But in any case, that's good that you did it.
I mean, there might be tricks, but at 4 or 5 in the morning, the trick I think of is take it in magma.
You're the friendliest people in the bus.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this guy wanted to invite me to a seminar at them on Tuesday so I could learn how to make money on the internet in my spare time.
Okay.
Oh, how friendly.
Cannot be open.
He said they have people in working on this
in the morning.
Here in Seattle and in Minnesota.
Oh, Steven.
I know
you to rip off.
No, not even the price. It's just...
I think
it's inherently worse than
it.
What they give it ADP or even the MNT.
But like...
Maybe what I had last time was just a bad death.
But I was going to tell me that people in Minnesota, I was going to be like, great, that's where I'm going to be this summer. Why don't I join you? And then, I had enough time to find out what it was. I was thinking of like running all the way around the number one path so I could like hear more about his plan. But we had to get off somewhere too.
I'd like to learn to make money on the internet.
But what happens is you get a bunch of people to put up websites and a bunch of banner ads, and then you just sit around clicking on each other's ads or something.
Wait, that's what this guy had to tell me.
No, that's my guess.
Oh, okay.
Scaling the average listening agencies.
You did that right, Baker. I can make a fortune emailing people that tell them about the great deals I can offer them on Viagra. It's a lucrative business.
I mean,
would
there
be
any changes?
Well, I reworded some of the beginning,
okay.
Changed some notation, and then wrote 2 pages. Mainly, I added section 11.2.1, which talks about modular.
6 pages.
Talks a little bit about modular forms.
There's 4 pages handwritten.
Did you include?
Yeah.
Actually,
it just sucks that you write all that.
Only like 4 lines at a time.
Steven.
All right, so let's get started. I'm going to pick up where I left off on the slide presentation from last time. And let's see, I will also talk some about the notes that I handed out. So here are examples of the first 150 multiples of the point 0, 0 on this elliptic curve. And you know, they look, so some of the points don't lie within this region, so you can't see them. They're up, you know, upstairs in my office or something, but you can see a lot of points are here and a lot of points are there. And in this picture, you don't really get a sense for how complicated these points are, but if we fire up a computer program, so I'm going to enter this elliptic curve. Which is, so the elliptic curve, remember there's a 5 tuple that corresponds to, there are new notes, by the way, if they're coming in late. So there's a 5 tuple that corresponds to an elliptic curve. So for this one, the 5 tuple is 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And then you can confirm that by printing out the curve. And, we can make the point 0, 0 on the curve, and then can compute multiples of the point. So what I'm doing here is I'm computing multiples of the point 0, 0. That is to say, I'm adding the point to itself multiple times and getting results. So instead of turning the lights off, it would be better if I just make the screen bigger. Is that better, or is that that's still too small, isn't it? Oops. Okay, so at first the points seem pretty small, but if you keep doing this, they get really big really quickly. So like 10 times p, 11 times p, 12 times P, 13 times P. And you can see they're getting quite big. By the way, the notation here, these are in projective coordinates. So this is a triple X, Y, Z. So if you want the point X, comma Y, you have to divide through by the bottom. So you get, in this case, you have this denominator that's to the right. So you can see the points are getting bigger and bigger. 20 times P, 25 times P, 30 times P, 50 times P. They're pretty big. So already 50 times P takes up the entire screen just for the x-coordinate, for the numerator of the x-coordinate. So if you take an elliptic curve, even with a very simple equation, and take a point on it, then sometimes, in this example at least, when you add that point to itself over and over again, you get points that are vastly more complicated than the points you start with. There's a good description of how much more complicated they become each time you add the point to itself. So you can look at what we have here, but let's just look at 2 times p, 4 times p, 8. Let's look at the powers of 2 times p and see how much more complicated they get as a function of the power of 2. So how are these coefficients growing? If you just look at the very first entry here, which is essentially the numerator of the x-coordinate. I mean, it looks exponential. It's or at least it looks really big at the beginning. So just to make it a little bit clearer, this little bit of notation means it'll just print out the number of digits. 46 digits. 183 digits.
I mean, it could be kind of misleading. Do we know the first coordinate's relatively prime to the third?
Let's see. Well, we don't know that for sure in this case.
I mean, it's likely that one of the first or second is probably.
Yeah, it is a little annoying printing this way. Oh, I'll switch to magma. The notation's almost the same in there. I think it prints just the x and y coordinates, I think. Oops, I have to say colon equals. Huh, why did that work? Oh, I know it happened. Huh. It shouldn't work unless I say colon equals. But anyways, so p is the point 0, 0, and then if we take, say, 32 times p, here it's dividing through. So I'll put the numerator of the first coordinate of 32 times p, and then I'll take log of that divided by log of 10, which is essentially the number of digits. That's minus 1. So I'll just make a little table. So 8, and then tell me if you see a pattern at all, so suggested by this table, as I double. So each time I'm multiplying the previous thing by 2.
They're like powers of 4, right?
Yep, that's right. So basically, the number of digits goes up by a factor of 4.
This is kind of a naive question, but
yes.
How often is Z
going
to be larger than, or larger or smaller than X and Y?
The three are roughly the same. There's not too much difference between them. I haven't thought about that question at all. So it's something you could probably answer pretty easily, but I don't know what the answer is. Yes.
Yeah. So in this case, it's kind of clear we have infinitely many rational points, but how easy is it to construct elliptic curves with finitely many rational points?
Let's see how to answer that. If you take a random elliptic curve, it's generally believed that there's a 50% chance it's going to have only finitely many rational points and a 50% chance it'll have infinitely many. So if you just choose a random curve, it will probably have only about 50% chance it'll probably have, I guess, the odds are about equal that it'll have infinitely many or finitely many. It's not really clear whether this guess is correct, but if you try curves, it's pretty likely that you'll find curves with finitely many points. Proving that they have finitely many points is an entirely different matter.
Well, like in this case, it's just the Lutz-Nagel theorem, isn't it?
That will allow you to show that this has infinitely many points.
Right.
Once you find, so this Lutz-Nagel theorem he's alluding to is the statement that if you have an elliptic curve given by a Weierstrass equation in minimal form, which means that there's a notion of discriminant for a Weierstrass equation, and if you make sure that the discriminant is minimal amongst all equations for that curve, then the x and y coordinates of any torsion point, any point of finite order, are integers. And moreover, those integers satisfy a divisibility condition relative to the discriminant. And here, you'll notice that, for example, at 5 times p, well, first I did give this curve a minimal form, and 5 times p, that's a point on the elliptic curve, and the coordinates are not integers, and therefore this is not a point of finite order, it's a point of infinite order. So you know this curve has infinitely many points. So I'll come back to that question though, about there are ways, for example, to construct infinitely many curves that are of rank 0, have finitely many points. But this is just to emphasize that the points get very complicated very quickly. And it's kind of amazing that, for example, that's a solution to the equation y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x. This determines for you rational numbers where the product of two consecutive ones is equal to the product of three consecutive ones. So that's y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x. If you factor both sides, it's a product of two consecutive numbers equals a product of three consecutive numbers. And if you keep iterating this process, you get infinitely many solutions to that problem. And they're extraordinarily complicated, but you get all solutions, amazingly, from the 1.00. It's an abelian group, and it's generated by the 0.00. I haven't proved that, but it can be proved. And again, this is just a picture of the first 150 multiples. There they are. So when you graph them as points on the plane, you can't really see that they're very complicated as rational numbers. They just look like points. All right, so here's... Oh, yes, please.
Are the points even? So it looked like almost all the points were close to the... were small in term viewed as a real number.
Mm-hmm.
Is that... Or do they go infinitely far out?
I think they go infinitely far out. And you kind of get a sense of what's going on from this picture. They're spaced out more and more, but I think if you consider more and more multiples, it should be dense everywhere, the set of rational points. Really what this, as a topological group, this is, it's just the circle across Z mod 2Z, and this generator, each time you're taking a multiple, you're bouncing it back and forth between the Z mod 2Z part being 1 or 0. And so you get a point here, and a point there, and a point here, and a point there, and a point here, and a point there. If you think about taking a point on the unit circle under multiplication and then taking powers of it, then as long as that point doesn't have finite order, I think it has to be dense in the unit circle. So,
yeah.
And topologically, this is just the same as that. So questions about density are equivalent. But you can get a sense somehow of a metric here. If you put an appropriate metric on this curve, then these points wouldn't be any farther apart than these points. But again, that's just something I'm throwing out there. Okay, here's one of the most fundamental theorems in the theory. It was proved, I think, it's the 20s. But I don't know the date. But it says if you take an elliptic curve over Q, then consider the set of rational points on the elliptic curve, the solutions. And as I explained last time, that's an abelian group. This abelian group is finitely generated. What that means is that there's some finite list of elements so that every element in the group is a linear combination of those elements. So because of the structure theorem for finitely generated abelian groups, the Mordell-Day group, that's what this group is called, is isomorphic to some power of Z directs on a finite torsion group. And there's a little note here. Mazur, who knows a professor here, his sort of most famous theorem is a classification of the possibilities for the torsion group T. So he proved a theorem in the 70s which said if you have an elliptic curve over Q and you consider the torsion subgroup of the Mordell-Day group, then it has to be one of the following list of possibilities. So you gave an explicit list of possibilities. The possibilities are
cyclic of order n for n up to 10, or n equals 12, or z mod 2z cross cyclic of order n for n equals 1, 2, 3, and 4. So those are the possibilities. And he showed that those are the only possibilities, and moreover that each one occurs infinitely often. I'll give you a very, very, very brief sketch of how he proved this. So again, Maser, his big theorem, if you like, his famous theorem is that if V is an elliptic curve over Q, then the torsion subgroup So for an abelian group, you have this canonical subgroup, the subgroup of elements of finite order. It's not a subgroup for a non-abelian group, but for an abelian group it is. Then this has an abstract abelian group. It's one of z mod nz, where n equals 1, 2, up through 10, or 12, or it's z mod 2z cross z mod nz, where n equals 2, 3, and 4. We already have one up here. So those are the possibilities. So how many are there? There's 11, 12, 13. Right.
It's 14.
I must be missing one then, because I'm sure there are 15. So that's strange.
Well, you could have no.
No, because that would be z mod 1z. 14 doesn't seem right to me. I must be misremembering. There's no way that it's 14. How about if I just show you the page where he states this in the actual paper? So, Bohm, Maser, papers. So, I'll show you the paper. It's very big. It's modular curves in the Eisenstein ideal. And here it is. And I'll zoom in. So here's his paper, modular curves in the Eisenstein ideal. And if we scroll down a little, we'll see the statement of this theorem. So he does a lot of other things that are used as input to the theorem. And here's the statement. So in fact, right, so I misremembered slightly. This should be 2n. And then you do include 1, because that does give you a different group. And then it's 15, which is what I remembered. So. But here's the statement of the theorem in his paper. Then it's one of those 15 groups. There's a handout somewhere right behind you. So here's just a quick sort of one-paragraph summary of how you prove a theorem like this. So here's what you do. It's really incredible that for every integer n, you can define a curve which is called x1 of n. And this curve has the remarkable property that it's a moduli space for pairs, an elliptic curve, and a point of order n. So this is this it's a curve whose points correspond to pairs, an elliptic curve, and a point P of order n. And then there's an equivalence relation of isomorphism on these curves. So you define a curve that parametrizes elliptic curves on the point of order n. And then what you do is you show that, well, you completely understand for every prime number P, you completely understand the rational points on this curve, on this algebraic curve. If you do that, then you understand the elliptic curves defined over Q that have a point of order P, and from that you can deduce this theorem. For example, when P equals 11, there's this curve x1 of 11, and interestingly enough, this curve, whose points, amazingly enough, parametrize pairs an elliptic curve with a point of order 11, itself, this curve turns out to be an elliptic curve. And what you can do is determine all the rational points in this elliptic curve. You find there are exactly 5, and they correspond to degenerate pairs like this. So there are actually some that are degenerate.
So you figure out what the points are here, you find none of them correspond to actual pairs like this, and hence you deduce that there can't be any elliptic curve with a point of order 11 defined over Q.
What does it mean to be degenerate?
So here's what I'll be a little bit more precise. You define first a curve y of n that parametrizes pairs, an elliptic curve in a point of order p, but this curve is not projective. It's not closed in projective space. It's a curve minus some points, a projective curve minus some points. Then you take the projective closure of y1 of n, and I drew that the wrong way. You take the projective closure of y1 of n, that's the curve x1 of n, and you can interpret the extra points you have to add in to compactify y1 of n as degenerate pairs in the elliptic curve with a point. But the degenerate just means that the extra points you add into the moduli space. So you have a picture here, if you like. Y1 of n is an algebraic curve, so if you consider its complex points, that's a Riemann surface that looks like maybe like this. And Y1 of n is missing a few points. It just turns out that when you make that parametrization space, the space whose points correspond to pairs in the elliptic curve and a point, that you're missing a few points. But then when you throw them in, you get this this algebraic curve whose complex points form a compact Riemann surface. So that's why I'm drawing a picture that looks like that. So in the special case of 11, you just get an elliptic curve, and then using various techniques, you can see that elliptic curve has only 5 rational points on it, and those rational points are just the extra things you added in. Hence, there's no elliptic curve with a point of order 11. And you do this for other primes, such as 23, 37, and so on. And of course, you can't do this on a case-by-case basis forever, but remember there's this thing, the Mordell conjecture, faulting theorem that I mentioned, which Maser doesn't actually use, but it's sort of intuition. It tells you that if you have a sufficiently complicated curve, then it has only finitely many rational points. So just the fact that you can define a curve whose points parametrize pairs, an elliptic curve with a point p of order n, well, you can see pretty quickly after you've defined this curve that as n gets large, the complexity of the curve gets large, and Faulting's theorem applies. So for n sufficiently large, and not very large at all actually, you see that this has only finitely many rational points. So just from Faulting's, if you didn't have Maser, you would know that there are only finitely many counterexamples to this statement for any given group. But what Maser does is use a whole bunch of machinery that's been developed over many decades to understand these curves really well, and he develops a bunch of his own machinery and eventually proves this statement. And he does it by showing that these curves, after a while, don't have any rational points, except for the ones that you add in when you go from here to here. So that's just the one paragraph summary of what Maser does. So that's just an explanation of... of this remark right here. Maser classified the possibilities for T. Here's a conjecture that Noam Elke's talked about in the number theory seminar yesterday at length, and it's kind of a folklore conjecture. Nobody really conjectures it or knows who would conjecture it, but a lot of people believe it, some people don't. But if you look at all elliptic curves over Q, does the R get arbitrarily big? Nobody knows for sure. In fact, of all curves people have ever looked at, the biggest we've been able to prove R can get is 24. Somebody has an example of a curve where R is at least 24. That was discovered, amazingly, about 5 years ago by two people at the National Security Agency. And it was really amusing. What happened was they found this curve, and then they said, hey, we know a curve with this property, but we can't tell you anything. Then finally they said, okay, here's a curve with rank at least 24. Here are 24 independent points on the curve. So you can show that they generate a subgroup that's of that's isomorphic to z to the power 24. And remember that if you have a subgroup of a finitely generated abelian group, it can't have more copies of z in it. That's something we know from the beginning of class. So they said that, but they didn't say why they were looking for it or anything else. So.
You probably know curves of every rank, and they're just not telling you.
Go. Okay, so Now I'm going to tell you
I'm going to come back to this in much more detail a little bit later, but so in the 60s, this guy Birch, who's pictured up here, he's now in his 60s in this picture, but back in the 60s, he did calculations with specific elliptic curves along with Swinnerton-Dyer on a supercomputer at at Cambridge University in the UK, and then he gave this lecture on the results of the computations. But basically, they calculated many quantities associated to an elliptic curve. So just like for a number field, remember, if you have a number field, if you just took a course in Galois theory, you might think, well, what can you possibly do with a number field? I mean, it's kind of fun. You can try to find the Galois group of its Galois closure, and there's a little bit to do there, and you have these elements you can play around with. But you probably wouldn't know that you can define the ring of integers, that you can define the class group, that you can define the group of units, that you could try to compute some of these objects, that that there are really, you know, basic open questions about them, such as, is the class group trivial infinitely often? There are all these questions that arise just from the definition of a number field that would be completely unclear to you if you didn't study them further. And the same is true for an elliptic curve. If you write down a single elliptic curve, you get a whole world. It's like the world you get attached to a number field. There is an analog of you have the Mordell-Weigh group of the elliptic curve. But there are many, many other groups that are attached to an elliptic curve that are very subtle to define. They're typically defined in terms of Galois cohomology or other constructions. So a whole bunch of other things here. Another example of something you can consider is the real points, the graph of the elliptic curve. And there's a certain good choice of a measure to put on that graph, and then you can... Well, a number associated to the elliptic curve is the measure of the elliptic curve. So this is a specific real number that you can attach to an elliptic curve, and there are many other quantities. And if you just compute all of these for an elliptic curve and throw them together, then and do this frequently enough, you discover an amazing conjecture. And that's what they did. So here's what they say. As a result of these computations that they did on their so-called supercomputer, we found an analog for an elliptic curve of the Tamagawa numbers in algebraic group, and conjectures have proliferated. Though the associated theory is both abstract and technically complicated, the objects about which I intend to talk, so it just means elliptic curves, are usually very simply defined and often machine-computable. Experimentally, we have detected certain relations between different invariants, but we have been unable to approach proofs of these relations, which must lie very deep. So they computed many things associated to an elliptic curve, found that these numbers all kind of, you know, if you multiply them all together in an appropriate manner, then you end up getting one, some sort of relation like that, or some relation between them. And they couldn't, you know, prove them at all in any particular case. In fact, it was at least 20 years after they made their conjecture until their conjecture was proved in even one case. So, for one elliptic curve. And here they are again a couple of years ago. I saw them at a conference. And the left is Birch and the other is Swinnerton-Dyer. So I saw them at this conference. I ran around, jumped in front of them, and snapped a photo.
Whoa, he's one person?
No, it's two people. Birch is here.
Swinnerton-Dyer
is here. Yeah, Swinnerton-Dyer is one person.
Okay.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, he's British, so he has a lot of last names. And he's actually a knight, too. Sir Professor Peter Swinnerton-Dyer. Yeah, I think he quit math for some time to be involved with politics, and I guess that helped him improve his chances of knighthood.
Yeah, probably good that he did Galois.
Yeah. Yeah. He ended up turning out. Yeah. So here's a definition of a function, and I will give a more motivated and precise definition of this in a few minutes. But if you have an elliptic curve over Q, you can define a function as indicated. This is similar to the definition that will be in the notes. But here there's a star, and that star is suggestive that this isn't exactly the thing that I'm going to define in the notes. But for the purposes of what I'm about to say, this will be enough. So here's what you do. It's just a completely kind of almost an elementary concoction, except for the fact that this is an infinite product. But this is the product over primes not dividing the discriminant of the Weierstrass equation. The discriminant of the Weierstrass equation, it's very simple, similar to the discriminant of a cubic. But it's an integer, and
if you have a prime that divides the discriminant, then if you take your elliptic curve and reduce it modulo that prime, you end up getting a singular curve. So that's how it's characterized. And
but you can define it precisely in terms of a formula. You can find that formula in any book on elliptic curves. So it's a product over prime. It's not dividing discriminant of that. So what this is, here S is, should think of this as being a complex number that you substitute in. And it's just a fraction, 1 over 1 minus this number AP, which I'll define in a moment, times P to the minus S, plus P times P to the minus 2S. And AP, here's the definition of AP. If you start with an elliptic curve over Q, and you take the Weierstrass equation for the elliptic curve, let's just suppose for simplicity that your curve is given by an equation like this. Well, you can just take this whole thing and think of it as an equation modulo P, and then count up the number of solutions there. Modulo P, you also have a group, assuming P doesn't divide the discriminant. Modulo P, you have a group as well, and you consider the order of that group. You count up the number of solutions modulo P. So for any particular prime, you could do this. For small primes, there are various tricks involving telling whether or not something's a squared quickly that will allow you to compute this number AP, which is the number of solutions to the reduction of the elliptic curve equation at line FP. Just to give you a sense of how fast one can compute these numbers A sub P, I'll just show you. I'll show you in Paris. And make sure my computer isn't running at super slow speed by running this program. Okay, so in Perry you say E equals L init. We'll take the curve from... Actually, I'll do it in Magma. I mean, Magma takes twice as long, but it's still pretty fast. So you just give the command traces of Frobenius, and then you give the number that you want. This is this gives you the A sub P for P up to the second argument. So... I didn't finish giving the definition. A sub P, it's got from the number of points. It's P plus 1 minus the number of points. The number of points over FP on an elliptic curve is always very close to P plus 1. But this AP is somehow a measure of the error. How much does it differ from P plus 1? And it's computed those for the first, for the primes up to 10, for the particular elliptic curve, y squared plus y equals x cubed minus x, that we've been considering, and you can see that that was very fast. Of course, that's not very impressive, because you probably could have done it in the amount of time we've been talking. So that's up to 100. You can do it up to 1,000, takes no time. 10,000, 0.08 seconds. 100,000, still doesn't even take a second to compute for every prime up to 100,000 these numbers. So you can compute them pretty quickly for a specific curve. Even a million, this will probably take 5 or 10 seconds. I don't know. It was actually an incredible breakthrough when people proved that you can compute the number of points on an elliptic curve over a finite field in time polynomial in the number of digits of P. This is a crucial result that if you didn't have it, it would be really a bad idea to use elliptic curves for cryptosystems. But given this result, the fact that you can compute the number of points in polynomial time means that you can use these for crypto systems as well. So for small p, you don't use this really sophisticated polynomial time algorithm. But if p is large, like 20 digits or something, it's still possible to compute the number of points, and you can do it in a reasonable amount of time. And this is important in cryptography, because if you take an elliptic curve over fp and want to use its group to make a crypto system, if it turns out that the number of points is a product of 2 or 3 or 4 small primes, then your crypto system will be very easy to break. So in order to use an elliptic curve for cryptography, what you want to do is find a curve so that the order of the group of points on the curve is a large prime number. If you have an elliptic curve over a finite field, and P of FP, this is a large prime number, and that prime number is not P or P plus 1 or P minus 1, then it is a large prime. If the number of points is a large prime, then this curve is probably good for cryptography. So the thing is, if it's a product of a bunch of small primes, then solving the discrete log problem in here is really easy. But I haven't talked at all about crypto, so I probably don't know what I'm talking about. But
Just as an aside, computing this even for P large is not too difficult. And the people who came up with this algorithm are Scoff. He first proved that you could compute the number of points in polynomial time, and then his algorithm was improved by Atkin and our very own Nomilkis. So it's called the C algorithm, SEA. So this is an algorithm for computing the AP quickly, at least for P large. In any case, you take these A sub P, infinitely many, all of them, and you combine them together, and you make a function, which is given by that product. And here's the motivation for considering this function. Now, by the way, it's not at all clear that this actually converges. It's an extraordinarily deep theorem that this does converge everywhere. This product only converges on some right half plane, but it extends uniquely to a holomorphic function on the whole complex plane. And so the function defined by that recipe, which clearly converges on some right half plane, actually determines a function on the whole complex plane. Interestingly, though, if you formally substitute 1 into this formula here, then multiply the top and bottom by p squared, look what you get. You get the product of p over p minus 8p plus 1. And p minus 8p plus 1, well, if you just reshuffle this equation slightly, is the same as the number of points on e over fp. So l evaluated at 1 is the product of p divided by np. Now, the significance of this is the following. If you had an elliptic curve and it had a lot of rational points, infinitely many rational points, then you might heuristically expect that when you take those points, you could reduce them. You could actually take the coordinates of the points and reduce them to fp. So, in other words, there's a map from e of q to e of e tilde of fp. And if this group is large, then that might imply that this group is a little bit larger than p on average. And that might imply that this product would somehow go to zero, or at least, well, this product would be zero, whatever that means. So you have this heuristic idea that maybe if this group is large, then that would force the bottom group to be large. Often, hence the numbers n sub p is just the number of points on e over fp, and so those numbers would be large, so that would be zero. Conversely, the heuristic guess is that if this is small, then maybe there's no reason for these to be bigger, and hence that number would be non-zero. So that's just a guess that Birch and Swearingen-Dyer operated under initially when they started doing computations. So then what happens if you kind of push that to its limits? By the way, here's a graph. If you take the L series, this infinite product indicated here, and draw a graph of it as a function of a real variable, then the picture looks roughly like this. So you can see that in this particular example, it does vanish at 1. So this heuristic suggests there should be infinitely many points, which is exactly what you see. Here's some other examples. The green line at the top, this is an example of a curve. In fact, this curve, x1 of 11, this is the L series of that curve. I mentioned that this curve has only finitely many points, and in fact, notice that at 1, the L function does not vanish. And then there are some other examples of things in here too. In fact, so the pink, the bottom curve that goes across, down, and then goes, it looks kind of like y equals x cubed. That's the graph of the L function for a curve of rank 3. It's a curve so that you require 3 independent generators to generate the Mordell V group. So actually, if you look at this data, if you look at the order of vanishing of the L function as compared to the rank, you notice that they seem to be exactly on the nose. It's not only the case that the L function should vanish at 1 if and only if there are infinitely many points, but more precisely, the degree to which these tend to be a little too big is exactly controlled by the rank. So if this is rank 5, the order of vanishing of the L function should be 5. So that's a chunk of the Birch and Swearingen-Dyer conjecture. So here it is stated formally. Take an elliptic curve over Q. the order vanishing of the L function, that's that function defined by the infinite product that I showed you before, and the thing that it was graphed on the previous two slides, the order vanishing of that function at 1 should equal the rank of the elliptic curve, where the rank is the number of points of infinite order needed to generate the Mordell-Weber modulo torsion. So remember, Mordell proved that E of Q is Z to the R plus a finite group, or the finite group, as we learned later, or as Maser proved later, is one of these possibilities, but the R, the Z to the R is the rank. So this is a conjecture. By the way, if you prove this conjecture, you get $1 million from the Clay Math Institute. This is one of, this is really their arithmetic geometry or algebraic number theory $1 million prize problem. So they chose two number theory problems. The other one's the Riemann hypothesis. So this one's, you know, similar to the Poincaré conjecture, the Riemann hypothesis in stature. And here's a really cool fact. The conjecture is true. It's a theorem. If the order vanishing of the function is less than or equal to 1. So if you take an elliptic curve and you find that the L function vanishes, it doesn't vanish at 1, or it vanishes just to order 1, so its derivative doesn't vanish, then you automatically know that the rank is equal to the order vanishing. So for example, if you write down an elliptic curve and compute and find the L function doesn't vanish at 1, then you know that there are only finite leading points with no further work. And this is a theorem of... So Colley-Vegan proved it, but his relatively short but extremely clever argument relies to a large extent of work of these two people, one of who you might recognize. What?
That took me a while.
Sorry.
I'm not awake for obvious reasons.
Homework? Or something? So let's try a random curve. So, I'll use Perry here. So let's make up a random curve. Somebody call it a number between 7. Oh. Another number.
13.
Minus four.
Zero.
One more.
18.
Okay, so there's a completely random curve. Now there's a function in Perry called L. Every function in Perry about elliptic curves starts with L, ELL, and there's a command called L series. And this very quickly computes the value of the L function at a given point. So let's just figure out what, so we can just do that. And this says that it vanishes at the point 1. So the Birch and Sorrentin-Dyer conjecture says, what does it say about the elliptic curve we just made up at random? Does it say it should have infinitely many rational points or finitely many rational points? Infinitely many rational points. So.
Just write it down up here. 7, 13, minus 4, 0, 18. So this means y squared plus 7, xy minus 4x, sorry, minus 4y plus x cubed plus 13, x squared plus 18. So the conjecture says there should be infinitely many points on that curve.
Now, the next natural thing to do would be to compute the derivative of the L function, find out whether or not it vanishes. So let's just, there are much more sophisticated ways for computing the derivative, but let's just use the definition of derivative. So you'll remember from calculus, if you can evaluate a function really precisely, you can approximate the derivative of the function at a point. You take f of x plus h minus f of x over h, and you take the limit as h goes to 0. So let's take... this plus, I'll make my h 0.001 and then divide by 0.001 and see what I get. So this should be an approximation for the derivative. But if this doesn't work, magma it'll compute the order of vanishing. Oh, there it is. So it says that the derivative is about 12.84. You can try a better approximation. But it says that an approximation for the derivative is 12.8416, which is not 0, which strongly suggests that this the order of vanishing is exactly 1 for this particular elliptic curve. So you can see that even when I increase the h, it isn't changing much. Or the epsilon or whatever. So there should be a point on that curve you chose. There's some rational point on there that... And the Mordell-Weber group should be generated by that point, modulo torsion. So what is it? So it we know there's a point there because of the theorem that Gross, Zagier, and Kollewegen proved. They proved that the Bertrand Smirton Dyer conjecture about the order of vanishing equaling the rank, they proved that's true as long as the order of vanishing is at most one. And in this case, the order of vanishing is at most one. And so you could somehow, hopefully, find a point on there. If you looked long enough, you would eventually find it, because it is there. You could just, you know, try all rational numbers up to some size, and eventually you're going to get there. These can be very hard to find in practice, though. Just for curiosity, I will throw a program at it. There's an open source program called MWRank that you type in a curve, and then it works really hard and tries to find the Mordell Bay group. And we're very lucky. It actually found it in 0.022 seconds, and the generator is right here. So there you are. All right, so back to the presentation. So you can see that this theorem is really, you know, useful. If you choose a random curve, it could very well be the case that the hypotheses are satisfied. And again, the expectation is that for a completely random curve, if you just write it down, chosen at random, then in fact the hypotheses are very likely to be satisfied. It's kind of hard to find curves that have abnormally large rank, that have more than just one point, more than rank one. But that's pretty good. Now, if you can, the next case is, what if the order of vanishing is 2? Then, here's a statement. If the order of vanishing is 2, then the Mordell Bay group is infinite. And that is a very difficult problem. And there's very little in the way of ideas for what to do there. I suggested it to Andre as a summer research project last summer, and wasn't it pretty frustrating? So maybe I'll have to do it in grad school. It's a very hard problem. A lot of people are stumped on that. Remember, I mentioned that you can take all these quantities associated to an elliptic curve and put them together in the right way, and you get a nice formula. And this is the conjectural formula you get. So what this says is the following. You take the L function. Now, notice there's no star in the definition here. So this is the genuine L function, not just the L function I defined before. The only difference is there are a finite number of extra factors for the primes that divide the discriminant. That's the only difference. So you take this function, you consider the leading coefficient. Here, R is the order of vanishing of the L function. You take the leading coefficient and its Taylor expansion about 1. And that number, which will be some real number, is supposed to be equal to this concoction on the right. So the simplest quantity here is the order of the torsion subgroup of the elliptic curve. So let's try to verify, let's see what happens with this conjecture if we take the curve you guys randomly made up and then see how many of the quantities in the conjecture we can write down. So we got the leading coefficient. When r equals 1, we've approximated it as being about 12.9. Remember, that was this computation right here. 12.9117. So 12.919. It looks like it's about 12.9. That's the quantity. So it's approximately 12.9. This is supposed to be equal to, so I'll put little dot dot dots. This is supposed to be equal to, and then go back to the lecture. It's supposed to be equal to something omega e, and something called the regulator of e, times the product of certain numbers c sub p, divided by the order of the torsion subgroup, times the order of some group called the Shapovalov-Tate group. This is an analog, it's somewhere about some group like that.
E of q's.
Yes, thank you very much. So I'm going to use either Perry or Magma to try to compute various quantities up here. There's one that's easy, which is in Perry you can say L tors and give it in a curve, and it will give you the torsion subgroup. It's a very easy thing to compute. By the way, Nagel-Lutz is not the way to compute the torsion subgroup of an elliptic curve, if you know about the Nagel-Lutz theorem. There's vastly better ways to do it. So I just want to spread that around in case anyone ever does implements this sort of thing. The problem with Nagaloots, you have to check all divisors of the discriminant, basically, yours. If the discriminant has a bunch of divisors, the number of divisors of a number can be exponential in the... And so, I mean, it's just very large.
Depends on the number of factors of the number.
Okay, so so the torsion subgroup is one in this particular example. So I'm just going to rewrite, copying over, filling in the blanks. So on the bottom, we have 1 squared. Okay, so there's also these numbers, Tamagawa numbers, and there's a command called, I think, L global red in Perry. And what it does is it outputs as the last thing, it outputs a vector as indicated. Sorry, that's hard to read. Maybe if I highlight it, it'll be a little clearer. Well, how about if I paste this down? Oops. Okay, so it outputs a triple, N, and then some numbers, and then C, where C is the product of the Tamagawa numbers. I haven't defined the Tamagawa numbers. In fact, it's pretty subtle to define those things. But they are computable very, very, very quickly by Perry, and Perry will output that product. So let's see what we get. So you just say L global red, and it says 1. So it says that this product is 1. Okay, so time to go number, product is 1, torsion on the bottom. Omega sub E. So if you take an elliptic curve, you say E dot omega, it gives you, as the first thing it outputs, I think it gives you the omega, which in this case is 2.14 dot dot dot. And this is something that can be computed using the Gauss arithmetic geometric mean. And the definition is it's the measure, it's an integral over the real points of the elliptic curve of a certain thing, a certain differential. And again, it could be written down completely explicitly. It's a real number, easily computable, attached to an elliptic curve. Okay, so that's omega. When we ran MW rank, this other program here, that very quickly found us the Mordelvay group, it outputs something called the regulator. So the regulator is a measure of how big the Mordelvay group is. And let me define the regulator for you now. So the definition will require a heuristic observation that you made earlier in class. So my goal is to define the regulator of an elliptic curve. And before defining it, I'll define one other thing, which is the height. So if you have a point on an elliptic curve, then you can define define the height of a point, x comma y. So these should be rational numbers. So I've divided through. There's no z here. And this is it's the logarithm of the max of the absolute value of x and the absolute value of y. So it's a measure of how many digits you have in the x. Max of the absolute value of the numerator of x. You don't worry about y at all. The numerator of x and the denominator of x. So
when x is reduced?
Yes, in lowest terms. X should be in lowest terms. So you write the x and y coordinates in lowest terms, and then a measure of the complexity of this point is you completely forget about the y coordinate, and you take the x coordinate and you look at its numerator and denominator, and you take the max of the number doesn't really matter which way you write this. I think I'll switch the order, and that's exactly the same thing. This log is increasing. Somehow I find it more intuitively clear about it this way. So in general, when you're measuring the complexity of something, you should always think of log as basically the number of digits. If this were log base 2 would be the number of binary digits, log base e is the number of e digits or whatever, but this is just a measure of the complexity of the
x coordinate of your point, which is a measure of the complexity of your point. That's what the height is. And there's one problem with the height, which is that it sort of doesn't have any good properties, really. But if you do the following, if you define h hat of p to be the limit as n goes to infinity of h of 2 to the n p over 4 to the n. So remember when we were looking at the multiples of a point earlier in the lecture, we looked at actual multiples, and we looked at something that was essentially the height in the sense that's given there. And we noticed that when you multiplied the point by 2 to the n, the number of digits went up by about a factor of 4 to the n. And that is, in fact, the case. And if you define h hat of p to be this limit, you get a very, very nice notion of height. And this height has good properties. One example of a good property is the height of m times p is equal on the nose to m squared times the height of p. Another nice property is that if you start with a torsion point, it will have height 0. A point is torsion if and only if it has height 0. And in fact, you can see that easily from the definition. Can anybody see why that would be the case? So the statement is, a point has finite order if and only if the height is 0.
Because h of 2 to the n times p is bounded, and 4 to the n isn't.
Right. Right.
Well, not
plot. It doesn't affect things.
Yes.
The 2 to the n just bounces the torsion point around some finite set. The set of heights you get here is finite, but 4 to the n is going to infinity, so it's got to go to 0. This is 0 if only if it's torsion. Yes?
So at the top of the screen there, when it gives a point and then says height below, is it the height of that point or the overall height, like the limit height?
It's the limit height.
Okay.
Yeah. People almost always work with the limit height.
And also notice, people almost always work with this limit height. And there you don't compute the height, by the way, by doing this. There's much, much better techniques. There's Joe Silverman has an important paper about how to efficiently compute heights. You decompose the global height, as this is called, as a sum of local heights. And then the local heights, there are efficient algorithms for computing each of those. So, you could compute it this way, but it takes a long time because you have to multiply p by 2 to the n, which you get this massive point. And there's much better ways to do it than just using this formula. There's also p-adic analogs of the height. Just a very quick aside. This is a height that... this is a height which maps the Mordell Bay group of your elliptic curve into the real numbers. And it's a nice quadratic function. And from this you get a quadratic, you get a bilinear pairing and so on. There's also analogs of heights for each prime p that map the Mordell Bay group of your elliptic curve into the p-adic numbers, in case you're curious. And until very, very recently, people didn't know how to efficiently compute these. But now we know how to efficiently compute these also. So in any case, you have this height, and the regulator, you define a pairing associated to the height. So define a pairing like this on the Mordell Bay group. And the pairing, this is just the natural way of associating to a quadratic function of bilinear form, which unfortunately I've completely forgotten, so somebody will have to help me out. How do you associate to, if you have a quadratic function, how do you get a bilinear form from it? It's some concoction.
It's like,
please?
It's like B plus W minus
something like this, so.
Minus h of p, minus h of q, probably. That's bilinear.
Okay. Sometimes you throw a half in somewhere.
Yeah, you can take the whole thing over too.
Okay, I'll put it all over too. Okay, are you happy? So there you get a bilinear pairing, and then if you take here's what the regulator is. It's just the discriminant of this pairing as a pairing on as a pairing on E of Q modulo torsion, since it's 0 on torsion. So you get a pairing on here, and you take the absolute value of the discriminant. So that means that you take a basis for E of Q modulo torsion, and then you pair each element of the basis with each other element of the basis. You get a matrix, compute the determinant of that matrix, and then take the absolute value of the result. So in the case that we're looking at, the random curve you made up, it's a 1 by 1 matrix, and
when you pair the thing with it itself, you end up getting just the height back, 6.03, etc.
So that's what goes here for the regulators, 6.03, etc. And then there's the Mysterious Shelf for which Tate group, and there's no easy algorithm to compute that. But it looks like the conjecture is true if the Shelf-Ravage Tate group has order 1. So you could view the conjecture, Bridge and Swinnerton Dyer, this more refined conjecture, which is on the slide here, as the assertion that the Shelf-Ravage Tate group of our elliptic curve has order 1.
Okay. So any comments or questions? So I took a random curve. Then we computed the order vanishing of its L function, and we got that it should be 1. It looks like it's 1. It is 1, actually.
And that took us the deleting coefficient, which was the number we got as the derivative, goes here. And there's various other quantities on the other side. And when you substitute everything but the mysterious order of this group in, you end up getting equality, assuming the order of this group is 1. So in order to fully verify the conjecture, you would have to show that the order of this group is 1. And that is possible for this example in theory at least.
Can it be done inefficiently by software?
For this particular example, if the order of vanishing is 0 or 1, it can be done inefficiently by software, yes. And it's getting more and more efficient.
Well, I mean, of course, because we know it's true for order of vanishing 0 or 1.
Well, so let's be careful. So Gross and Zagi and Kleving, here's what they proved for order of vanishing 0 or 1. They proved that the rank, the conjecture, by that I mean this conjecture here, that the order of vanishing equals the rank is true. This formula, though, has not been proven even for order of vanishing 0.
Okay.
I mean, it hasn't been proven in those special cases. There are results towards it that reduce verifying it to a finite computation when the order of vanishing is 0 or 1. However, if the order of vanishing is 2, this formula has never been verified for even a single elliptic curve. So here's an example of an elliptic curve for which the order of vanishing is 2.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
If it's never verified or something, how can they conjecture?
When they conjectured, it wasn't verified for any curves at all. So I just want to show you an example of it. They're right, so there's a curve with order vanishing 2. For that curve, we don't know that this conjecture is true. Sorry, I just flipped it away, but it's the one at the bottom of the screen. That one has order vanishing 2. How can they conjecture it? First, if you look at the formula here, and you look at the analytic class number formula, and you look at the introduction to André Georges' thesis, see if I woke you up, then you'll find that he nicely describes how they're very analogous. So the analytic class number formula, that's something that there's a way to define L functions by, it's a concoction that involves the norms of primes. It's kind of like the definition of L function I gave here, very similar. And there's a theorem that says that a formula very similar to this is true there. So that's a good reason to conjecture this. Also, there are consistency results about this theorem, and that's what André's thesis is about. If this conjecture is true for one elliptic curve, and you have a morphism of finite degree to another elliptic curve that's surjective, called an isogeny, then it's automatically true for the other elliptic curve, which is strong evidence for the conjecture. If the conjecture were wrong, maybe something would go wrong going from here to there. Also, there's a vast generalization of this conjecture known as the Bloch-Kato conjecture, which is an analog of this for motives. So,
what is the conductor of the elliptic curve?
I have no idea. Let's see.
It would be interesting to see if we checked it.
Oh, no, sorry. I need to do it for our curve. L global red. Okay, no, it's huge. Look, that's the conductor. The conductor is an integer attached to an elliptic curve that measures properties of the elliptic curve.
the full formula has not been checked for this one.
No, it has not been checked. And the conductor in this case is 2 times that very, very large prime. But it could be checked in theory. Okay, so back to the notes. One of my research projects is giving efficient algorithms for checking that this conjecture holds for specific curves. So it's something I've been working on with many undergrads here, like Karina, who's not here today, and should be here today, especially today nowadays, and Andre and Stefan Patrikas and various other people. All right, so the next thing I want to do is show you some photographs, if you like, or some graphs of L series of elliptic curves. And actually, I want to also show you graphs of modular forms attached to elliptic curves. So I can't really do that if I don't define them for you, but let's see. So I'm going to tell you how to associate a modular form to an elliptic curve. Actually, what I'll do is I'll tell you how to associate a function to an elliptic curve, and then the famous modularity theorem of Wiles, Taylor, Bray, Conrad, Diamond, Taylor tells you that the function that I am going to write down right now associated to an elliptic curve, well, if you were to draw its graph, it has lots and lots of nice symmetries. So just to kind of give you a visual picture of what I mean by that, I'm going to see if I can find a good example. Okay, so this is a graph of a complex analytic function, and this is the argument of that function. And there's some symmetry somehow. There are lots of reflections. If you take a piece of this graph and then transform it using a linear fractional transformation and then change it in a certain way, you get something that looks very similar to what you started with. So this picture looks very symmetric in some sense relative to some group of linear fractional transformations. This is a graph which illustrates how something is a modular form. But let me precisely define the modular form attached to an elliptic curve. So here we have an elliptic curve E over Q. And this is in our notes. Are there any copies of the notes left? So it's the last section of the notes, I think. Right. So if you look at the last section, 11.2.1. So what is the domain of that graph? Well, that graph is just some little square somewhere, but let's let H be the complex upper half plane. And I'm going to define a function that's defined on the upper half plane and amazingly has huge numbers of symmetries. The existence of the symmetries is not at all obvious from the definition, but here's the definition. So first, define numbers A sub P exactly as I define them over there. So AP for primes that don't divide the discriminant, for primes of good reduction, so when you reduce the curve, you get a curve with no singularities. That's P plus 1 minus the number of points on the curve over FP. So this is for good primes. So for all the finely many primes, you have these numbers. They're integers. They're P plus 1 minus a number. There's another recipe. If you consider a cubic curve and it is singular, there are only two possibilities for what the singularity looks like, at least over the real numbers. But if you reduce an elliptic curve modulo P, there are three possibilities for the singularities. So if it looks like this modulo P has a cusp, then AP is by definition 0. If it looks like this, then it's 1. And if it looks like this, then it's 1, then it's minus 1. Where the difference between these two is that the slopes of the tangent lines in this case are not defined over FP. They're elements of FP squared. So it's a slightly technical thing, but slopes are not in FP. But you can imagine choosing a prime P and writing down an equation for some curve that has a singular point, but the slopes of the tangent lines, when you do the calculus, when you use calculus to find the slopes of these tangents at the point of intersection, so these two lines, you can imagine that maybe they wouldn't lie in FP. That does happen sometimes.
So this is a recipe for A sub P, and it's a recipe for all primes. For the good primes, you have this formula that involves counting, and for the bad primes, you have either 0, 1, or minus 1. Now, I'll extend the recipe to a formula for all A sub N, not just prime subscripts, but all subscripts. And once I've done that, I can easily define for you a function and completely describe how I drew that graph. There's really no magic in drawing that graph, given the definition that I'm about to make. So here's the concoction. So define A sub N for all integers N greater than or equal to 1. So here's the way you do it. It's an inductive definition. If you have two co-prime integers N and M, then A sub N times M is A sub N times A sub M. That's if N and M are co-prime. And there's one other case that allows you to completely describe this. So for any prime power, AP to the R is, fortunately there are two cases for this, but AP to the R minus 1 times AP minus P times AP to the R minus 2. And that's in the case when P is good. And when P is bad, it's just AP, the whole quantity raised to the R. Be bad. Okay, so it's complicated, but it's pretty elementary. Checking which of these cases occurs is just kind of a calculus thing over a finite field. This is counting points, but I mean, how you efficiently do this, that can be pretty complicated, but you could imagine doing it somewhat inefficiently, and there's really nothing incredibly deep about just considering the number of points over FP. You could explain that to almost anyone, I hope. Maybe I can't, but you could. And then this definition, this is just multiplicativity when they're co-prime, and when it's a prime power, you have a little recipe like this. It's complicated, but not ridiculously so. Okay, so I've defined now integers A sub n, one for every positive integer n. And now you can associate, you just put them together in a function, and here's the function. So you take this package of numbers and you define f sub e of z to be the formal, well not formal, it's a function, sum n equals 1 to infinity a sub n e to the 2 pi I n z.
I bet I forgot the n.
Yeah, in the notes I forgot the n. So.
It would be really dumb without the n, of course, because then you just factor it out.
So that's it. There's a function. So you can wonder about convergence of this series. View this. This is supposed to be a function on the upper half plane to the complex numbers. So just to get a sense of convergence, imagine you were to plug I into this. Then you get e to the minus 2 pi n. And that the e to the minus 2 pi n, that goes, as n gets large, that goes to 0 very, very quickly. And one could show that the a sub n are bounded in absolute value by n. They're very small. So, here's that. So just to address convergence, the a sub n have absolute value less than or equal to n. Actually, I never saw this anywhere in the literature, and I asked Andre, our CA, last summer, and he produced a proof of this statement. In the literature, you see kind of a statement without a proof, where you see that it's a sub n is less than a multiple of n for some fixed multiple or some asymptotic statement. But it's actually true on the NIST. Okay, so this is a function on the upper half plane, and there's a graph of this function. I made this graph by simply computing a large number of terms of the expansion. This is for some curve of rank 1, in case you care. And then I just plugged in complex numbers, lots and lots and lots of complex numbers as you go across and as you go up. And I computed the argument of the resulting truncated sum, and then I graphed. And here, blue is really small and red is really large. Where really small and really large mean blue is 0 and red is, you know, close to 2 pi. So the argument is normalized between 0 and 2 pi. And this isn't just some random-looking function. It appears to have a lot of extra symmetry. extra symmetry far beyond what you might guess just based on the recipe I've given you for the definition. The recipe I've given you for the definition doesn't suggest this function would have any new properties or symmetry, but it does. And that's a very deep theorem that it does. So now I'm going to tell you exactly what the extra symmetry is. And here's what it is. So theorem. So this is the theorem of Weyl's ray Conrad Diamond and Taylor. By the way, Brian Conrad is giving the number theory seminar on April 28th. And Taylor's the Taylor, he's a professor here. It says that F sub E is a modular form. And I'll tell you essentially what that means. Some very slight hidden thing in the IE, but it means that there's an N. Such that for every, and I'm just describing the symmetries you see in the picture, for every A, B, C, D, this is a 2x2 matrix with integer entries. With determinant 1. And n divide c, we have I'll just put it here. We have f of az plus b over cz plus d is equal to cz plus d minus 2 f of z. That's it. That's an incredible amount of symmetries.
Should it be like 2n or n as the exponent?
Nope. It's just 2.
Well, then
what
is
n?
Yeah,
n divides c.
N divides c. N is the conductor, by the way. Remember we were mumbling about the conductor? This n, the best n you can choose for which this is true is the conductor. The only way n appears here is it's a constraint on the matrices that you consider. And I can write, in case you know more about this, I can write on SL2Z, but this means the group of 2x2 integer matrices of determinant 1. So then I can eliminate that condition. And notice if you take two matrices and the lower left entry is divisible by n, their product will also have that property. And if you take a matrix like that, its inverse will also have that property. So you get a subgroup of SL2Z, which is called gamma 0 of n. And to be a modular form means that there's an n so that for every single element of the group gamma 0 of n, the transformation given here is satisfied. Yes?
Is there any other way of generating modular forms for the
yes.
Like arise somewhere?
There's a very systematic way of you have an input an integer n, and you get output a list of all the modular forms of for a given n. Yes?
Like
yeah.
How is the n and the modular form
related? Here's the n. In the picture here, the n is a condition on the lower left entry. Maybe it's a little nicer if I just say for all a, b, c, d, and sorry to change it again, in the group gamma 0 of n, which is the subgroup of SL2Z of 2x2 matrices with lower left entry divisible by n. A subgroup of SL2Z. So for each of these special subgroups of SL2Z, you have you can consider all the functions on the upper half plane that transform in this way, and there's some additional condition about them vanishing at some boundedness condition. On, you don't want them to blow up at infinity or something, but you consider all the holomorphic functions that behave exactly in this way for every single element of gamma 0 of n, and it turns out it's a finite dimensional space and it's computable. Um,
so we're done. But just one thing to point out is this condition, though it looks really strange, if you write the formal expression f of z v z, this condition is simply the condition that f of, if gamma is a, if gamma is the function gamma z equals a z plus b over c z plus d, then this condition here that looks kind of contrived is just the condition that f of gamma z d gamma of z is equal to f of z dz. That's all it is. So to be a modular form, it means that if you consider f of z dz, it's invariant, that differential is invariant under the action of gamma 0 of n, which means it defines a function on a differential on the quotient of the upper half plane by gamma 0 of n. Okay, so I'm going to stop because the lecture's ending there. But
there are problems with this.
How does that like correspond to the usual definition of a modular form, which is like invariant under all of SL2 and
that's a modular form of level 1. These are modular forms of weight 2 and higher level. There's two directions. They're actually so generally you define modular forms of weight k and level n. And the so-called usual definition that you know about is level 1 and invariant, and there are a whole bunch of different weights. But this is level n and weight 2. And I understand what you're concerned with here. When you define a modular form of weight k, then the k goes in the exponent.
Right.
So when you define a modular form of weight 2 and level n, which is what the what is attached to an elliptic curve, then you just have 2 in the exponent, and the n appears in, it's a constraint on which matrices you allow.
I think I was mainly confused there because like you said it's a modular, and it's not specifying that weight.
Right, well, weight 2. Everything, they're all weight 2. The weight isn't implicitly specified by putting it 2.
Oh, yes.
You could rephrase this as f is a modular form of weight 2, i.e.
You have
really. That's
the name
of the
handle.
It's like
/campHF.
Oh, did you ever determine if there was class on Tuesday?
No.
Hey,
Harvard
people?
Students, we know.
Is there class here on Tuesday?
Probably
MIT doesn't have class. Patriots Day weekend.
Oh, yeah, we get class.
This couldn't be my afternoon
class. Oh, we already have that, right?
No. No.
Okay.
And I also rewrote some of your other.
Sorry,
ones.
I totally oversigned the
extension
page.
I was
looking
at
the
problems with the
list
already.
I'm
not
going.
I have a
137
set.
I really
can't
work.
137.
Yeah,
sure, yeah.